behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the show. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben. As always, we are joined by our super producer, Noel the Explorer Brown. And today, we're going a little bit further from the U.S., not too far.
Eventually crossing through.
Eventually. We're making our way. We're moseying on down. What are we talking about today, Scott?
Well, today is the, I'll give you the Spanish name, Ben. It's the Expedición de las Americas.
And for those of us who do not have Scott's polyglot skills, that is the Expedition of the Americas.
Ah, yes. I'm sure everybody kind of picked up on that. But this is something that happened back in, 1978 to 1979.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a suggestion from a listener named Ben H. out of North Carolina. And Ben wrote in a long time ago. So I hope Ben's still listening.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those ones that we picked up in our nuts and bolts, or maybe it was a listener mail episode, mm-hmm. I think we did, where we caught up from a long time ago, months and months ago.
Yeah.
And this is one of those topics, and I thought this was an amazing story. This could be like an epic tale, really.
Oh, yeah.
However, we're going to, you know, keep it brief, and we'll let you investigate it a little bit on your own as well, because there is a 27-minute, I think, documentary
mm-hmm.
on this whole thing, this whole trip from beginning to end. And it's well done. It's very 1970s, the narration and the music, and it almost has some folk music along the way that was written specifically for this. It's an interesting watch. So if you get a chance to watch the video that goes along with this, please do.
Mm-hmm.
You can find it on YouTube or Vimeo or a lot of those places. But let's start right from the beginning, Ben, because, you know what? How about this?
All right.
We'll just tell everybody what it's all about first, and then we'll just start from the beginning and tell them, like some of the hardships that they had along the way.
Oh, yeah.
So the idea is that this group of guys, that these off-road enthusiasts,
mm-hmm.
None are really professional, I don't think. They are going to take on the Pan American Highway from beginning to end. And not only that, they're going to extend it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to go a slightly different route because they want to go from the southernmost tip of the Americas, which is way, way, way down in
Chile, right?
Yeah, it's in Chile. That's right. It's Tierra del Fuego, Chile, which is the southernmost point of South America. And then they were going to go all the way north to Prudhoe Bay.
Mm.
And that's the roughly the northernmost part of North America that you can get to.
Close enough for government work. This is a team of 14 intrepid off-roaders led by a gentleman named Mark A. Smith.
Yeah, Mark Smith. Now, Mark is he's an off-road enthusiast, and I have to read maybe a description of who this guy is just so you get an idea of what he's up to here.
Mm-hmm.
But he's the founder of what we know as the Jeep Jamboree,
mm-hmm.
way back in the 1950s, and it was just kind of started because he loved Jeeps. He liked driving them. So let's see. Here's maybe the best description of him. He's the son of a miner, and he grew up in Nevada and San Francisco. So mostly in San Francisco area. He served time as a Marine near the end of World War II, where he drove his first Jeep. So at the end of World War II, that's his very first experience. And in 1951, he settled in Georgetown, California, and he worked as a logger and a sheriff and eventually went into real estate. He founded the Jeepers Jamboree in 1953, so he's been doing this a long time at this point.
We've talked about Jeep Jamboree on the show before.
I think we have, and
yeah.
Camp Jeep and all those
mm-hmm.
other, you know, Jeep mm-hmm. 101, and there's a lot of off-road activities around, or gatherings, I guess, around
mm-hmm.
the Jeep brand and other off-road brands too, but Jeep seems to have this huge, huge following, and it goes all the way back to the 1950s when he organized the Jeepers Jamboree.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that eventually just became the Jeep Jamboree.
Yeah, and it really took off in 54 when Willys Motors got involved.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, it's like a worldwide thing now. I mean,
yeah.
People come from all over the world, and he continued to sponsor and drive Jeep events all across the country for another six decades after you know, he initially did this in the 1950s. So it's been a long, you know, he's been around doing this a long time. He's not around anymore. I believe he passed away, and I think it was in 2014 when Mark passed away. But we're talking about something that happened about 40 years ago now. So
mm-hmm.
he was not a young guy even then when he did this. He was an older guy, not one of the oldest on the trip, because the trip had a wide range of ages. Went from, I think one guy was 19 who took this trek with him, and another guy was in his mid-60s, and then everything in between, and from all different walks of life. But like I said, none of these guys were really considered, like, I guess, professional off-roaders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He passed away at the age of 87. It was June 9th, 2014.
2014. And, you know, you're going to find a lot of photos of him standing next to at least one of those Jeeps from this this excursion we're talking about. And they're red, yeah, CJ7s. So, I mean, even as an old-timer, he's still around the Jeep product, and I'm sure that he was driving probably right up until the day he died almost. You know, this
right.
is that's his kind of thing. It's his lifestyle. But what a trip these guys took back in 1978.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is around about 20,000 miles of road, of travel.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see why I say travel instead of road all the way, because that's – at times the definition gets stretched and at times it doesn't apply. So they took all Jeep CJ models and left 1978 on one of the most epic road trips in history. And you know we love to explore road trips. Scott, you mentioned some of the – you alluded to some of the trials and travails the group would encounter in their journey. And let's get one of these out of the way, depending on how you want to do this. We have to mention Darien's Gap.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Darien's Gap. So the Pan American Highway is a fascinating thing. And if you ever get the chance to travel it, first, take it. You know, even if you can't go all the way, it's a network of roads that's about 90,000 miles in total length. And it links up almost all of the countries in North and South America. But there's one place in that road, and it's called Darien Gap.
Yeah, the Darien Gap. Now, this is an interesting bit of terrain here because this is, as we said, it's jungle, it's swamp.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, it's almost like impenetrable jungle, really. It's,
yeah.
It's very, very dense. Even you can't really walk across this. And here are these guys with six Jeeps and 14 people, and they're going to try to make their way through.
Right. This is some nasty territory to try to drive through. It's beautiful from a naturalist perspective, but when it comes to a road trip, it's one of the biggest pains in the keister you could imagine. It's located in Central America in the northern portion of Colombia and into Panama.
Yeah.
And it's super expensive to try to build roads here, or even a lot of development that would not be unreasonable in other places is very difficult, and the environmental cost is very tough. Add to that the fact that this would have to span across these two countries in that area, and there's a political part to it as well. So this is the infamous missing link of the Pan American Highway.
Yeah, it's a place where they're not going to pave, they're not going to put a bridge in, they're not going to cut a way through there. And the reason, or there's reasons, I should say, that they're not going to do that. And it's kind of controversial. They've actually kind of started to do that, and then
right.
and then backed it down. That was back in the early 1970s, like 1971, I think, or at least the planning stages. They halted it in 1974 after environmentalists raised some concerns. I think it was, about cutting down the jungle, you know, cutting a way through there and allowing traffic to go through that area. Another effort to build a road through there began around 1992, but by 1994, the UN, United Nations Agency, reported that the road and the subsequent development that would go along with it would cause extensive environmental damage. So again, environmental damage, they tried about 20 years apart to do it, but, they got, you know, pushed back again. And then another reason, this is maybe one of the better reasons for them to not do this, I think. And, of course, the environmental is important, but listen to this, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
There's evidence that the Darien Gap has prevented the spread of diseased cattle into Central and Northern America because it's a complete block. You can't get through there. So they have not seen foot and mouth disease since 1954, and at least since the 1970s, it's been a substantial factor in preventing the road going through the Darien Gap. So it's not just that they don't want to cut down the jungle. They don't want to put pavement where there wasn't pavement before. They're concerned about getting foot and mouth disease, you know, with cattle crossing back and forth. So it's a smart move, I think, on their part. Also, there's the potential erosion of the indigenous people's culture, that right now keeps them separate. And that is, in a way, that's good. I mean,
yeah.
Of course, it's always good to integrate a bit, but this is – it's also going to erode that culture. It's going to
it's going to assimilate the people in some way. It could lead to exploitation because, unfortunately, what we've seen throughout history is that when there are native populations, native peoples living in that kind of isolation, the modern world often has dangerous effects, you know.
Dilute. That was the word I was looking
dilute.
For.
Dilute. Yeah, that's a good word. Yeah, that's a good word.
Dilute the culture, I guess, in a way.
Well, yeah, that's part of it, but it can also lead to dying out of a language. It can also lead to exploitation of individuals for various purposes.
Also, there could be like a disease factor.
Exactly. That's a big one.
Just not the immunity to the same things.
Never been exposed.
Exactly right. And so there's a lot of issues with that. And again, this Darien Gap bit here, we're focusing on that right now, but prior to this, there's 10,000 miles of travel, and then after this, there's another 10,000 miles
right,
of travel.
Yeah.
So this is an important thing here. This Darien Gap, they said, is kind of like the crux of the whole expedition. And honestly, like to just look at this, I mean, to look at the wall of jungle that they had to drive into is incredible. So how did they do it? How did they get Jeep vehicles through this jungle that, oh, by the way, it had been crossed only once before. Prior to this, and there was a British army, I believe, that did it on foot. It took them months of time to get this army through there, and they lost a lot of men. They had a significant death toll as they tried to get through, and also they had a lot of illnesses from mosquito bites and, you know, things like that along the way. So it was very almost like a crippling journey for them to get through. And these guys are going to try to do it in a short amount of time with Jeeps, and they did it in just 30 days. They crossed it in 30 days. With the help of indigenous tribes and the Colombian army. Now that's important because these guys were the ones that walked out front with machetes in hand.
Yeah.
Cut the old, you know, undergrowth away and the vines and all that, you know, left behind some of the bigger trees and things for the, you know, those guys to cut down. But they were chopping this, this trail. They knew exactly how wide they had to cut it and how high they had to cut it.
Right.
They made a tunnel pretty much through the jungle and allowed them to drive through. I mean, we're talking like, sometimes just yards at a time. I mean, during a day.
Right. This is a very dense area. And these were stock Jeeps. These were just regular CJ7s. They didn't have a whole bunch of, I don't know what you would imagine when you think of jungle modifications.
Yeah,
you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Good point, Ben, because they didn't have the factory, build them special equipment.
Right.
That's maybe the best way. They were stock, I agree, but they had 31-inch tires. They also had, I'm sure they had some reinforcements in areas that they themselves put on. But it was pretty much stock Jeep. So they head out and they've got this incredible sense of adventure and they're just like, the epitome of Boy Scout mentality, the be prepared thing, right? Like they're prepared for everything. They've got these special built ladders that are on top of the vehicles. They've got, of course, welding equipment is on board because I think they did end up breaking an axle while they were in the jungle. They use winches to pull themselves up ridges when they can't drive up because these are steep. They're going over washes and things, you know, that you can't get over. And so what they do is they would cut away the undergrowth, lay down these metal, look like ladders almost. I think they were aluminum, I think, or maybe not. They were lightweight. They would lay down these aluminum ladders and they would drive over them. They're special built, of course, you know, to withstand the weight. But they would almost become engineers in a way, in the way that they figured out how to make these ladders work to get over these sometimes 30-foot deep washes. Sometimes they were 5 feet. You know, they were varying in size as they crossed this jungle area. But what a trek. I mean, and to watch them do that, it's really pretty clever how they did it. It's almost like those treks that would lay out the road in front of them.
You have to move slowly and surely. Also, they didn't make the entirety of the gap by traveling on land. They spent a lot of time traveling by barge across what's known as the Atrato River in Colombia.
Yeah, so they went on barge, and I also saw if you watch this this film, and I encourage you to watch it. It's again 27 minutes, but it's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Part of this, the way they crossed one of the rivers, and I don't think it was in the gap. I think it was maybe somewhere else, maybe in Mexico somewhere or something. But this is so interesting. They would drive. They had to, of course, hack a trail down to the river bank. They'd drive down, and then they laid those ladders that I was telling you about, the ones that they drive over. They laid them across canoes. You have to picture, like, maybe three canoes, really long dugout-type canoes, almost like tree trunks,
Yeah.
But really long. Three of them in a row, and you would drive across them. It's not, you know, with them, but across them, mm-hmm. on those ladders. And then people would get in the water and then push the canoes sideways across the river to get them across. And then they would drive off the ladders and onto the other side. It was brilliant. And I don't know if I would trust, I mean, looking at what they were floating on, I don't know if I would trust the weight of a full Jeep on there.
Yeah.
Because it's loaded down with all of their expedition equipment too, all the food, all the water filtration stuff, you know. They're heavy. They're not really lightweight vehicles. To me, that was one of those things that just really stood out in this film is like, man, these guys are just so clever about how they're getting across. They had to have had that planned out well ahead of time.
Right. This is a slowly but surely wins the race kind of strategy, yeah. which is, as we can see, the only one that'll work there. Before we talk more about the different things they faced, I got to tell you, I know I jumped straight to Darien's Gap, but it's because it's a fascinating patch of land. I mean, it's big to call it a patch. But, Scott, there's another thing we didn't talk about, which is that on a personal, like a social level, Darien's Gap is dangerous. It's been described as a refuge for the lawless.
Really?
Because it's impenetrable. Yeah. Huh. Well, because it's, you know, not impenetrable, but.
It's a great hideout.
Yeah. It's a great hideout, actually. Yeah. And you can read different depictions of some of the settlements or areas in there. One in particular is a place called Yaviza. Which is famous for being lawless. It's described as, get this, man, a magnet for fugitives, poachers, and bootleggers.
Now, Yaviza is on the north end. That's the last, I guess that's the town where the road ends and the gap begins.
Exactly.
And
it's
on
right
the
on
other
the
side, you know what the name of the one is on the south side?
What's the one on the south side?
Turbo.
Turbo.
It's named Turbo. Yeah. T-U-R-B-O, Turbo. Yeah, it's an interesting name. But so they traveled between Turbo and Yaviza through this jungle. And as we said, they were hacking away all this stuff, you know, along the way. And you said it's dangerous through there as well.
Yeah.
Totally get that. They said mosquitoes were a constant issue for them. You know, the temperatures. Oh my gosh. We didn't even talk about the temperatures.
Oh, right. We have to.
Up to like 105 degrees during the day. And then, of course, humidity is
Fahrenheit for our international friends.
Yeah. That's 105 degrees Fahrenheit. And humidity was nearly 100% the entire time. So this trip had to be pretty miserable on these guys along the way. And, oh, we did also say this.
Hmm.
As they were chopping, you know, they would chop a few yards at a time and just some days they would only go maybe 500 feet at the most. And other days, as they got this rhythm going, as they figured out, you know, the choppers knew just how much to cut down and what they needed, they got a better rhythm going and they could go, you know, 3, 4, or even 5 miles a day, which was a huge jump because we're talking about, you know, covering a pretty good distance here. So,
yeah.
And by the time they got to the end of it, you know, when they're exiting, the trail on the south side was already overgrown again. It was gone.
Yeah.
There's no more trail. So it's not like, you know, this trail was going to remain for a long time or it did any permanent damage. Mm-hmm. The jungle healed itself so quickly that there was no trace of them anymore on the south side. That's incredible to me.
Mm-hmm.
It took, and it's what, 31 days, I said?
For a jungle to be that voracious, yeah.
Yeah, 31 days to get through there. So it gives you an idea of just how quickly this thing can heal itself. It's really remarkable. I bet if you did build a highway through there, maintenance, like just daily maintenance, would be unbelievable. It's almost like when they build a highway through a desert or something. You know,
yeah.
You have to watch the sand blowing over, like almost like snow would drift over a road.
Right. And there's another consideration, too, with the road construction there, which is that, well, here's the best way to put it. The dilemma is this. It is possible at great expense to build a road through that area. However, to build a road through that area that would last and be drivable, you would have to raise parts of it. You know what I mean? Like sow the earth with salt kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you would have to destroy a vast amount of it to make it happen. Cause you'd essentially, one way or the other, you'd be cutting it in half. That's how the road works.
You know what I just love about all this? I mean, along the way, they knew sort of what to expect, but they didn't know everything.
Yeah.
You know, so they set out these 15 guys, they set out and they all have to be just excellent problem solvers and they all have to count on each other. They all have to know the other one's got their back. They all have to really like trust one another in order to make this work. Cause if one person isn't pulling their weight or if they're not doing what they're supposed to do or they give up or they're, you know, they get homesick and they want to stop the thing or whatever.
Game over.
It is because all these guys, they're just like, I mean, just in general, they're just people from ordinary walks of life. I mean, they have jobs, they have families. The families, you know, in a lot of cases just said, just go do it. When are you ever going to have, you know, 4 months opportunity to do something like this ever again in your life? And you're going to get to see all of the Americas. Do it. You know, just go. So they had a lot of support from their families, you know, and the camaraderie between the guys on this trip. You're going to see that in that film, too, just how well they get along. At the end of the trip, you would think that maybe there's a little, you know, a little friction between them. But they were happier than ever at the end. They were almost sad to have to, you know, go back to their normal lives, as I can imagine. You know, going back to work would be a little difficult after something like this. But at the end, they were just super happy that they had done it. They were excited about, you know, these lifelong friends now that they had made. And again, it all worked out perfectly in the end. They worked together well. They all were excellent problem solvers. It was an interesting time for all of them, I'm sure. And it's fun for us to look at and read about.
Yeah. While they were in the gap, they had to use a filtration system to get water, and they lived on like freeze dried fruit and stuff.
Yeah.
They have vegetables and meat, but they had to bring their own rations is the point.
Well, for that part of it. Yeah. Because the other rest of the time they're stopping in towns and things.
Right.
And,
yeah.
Or they camping,
go through, they go through Costa Rica, Panama City, you know, they go through places that are inhabited, but that it's still, there's still some things that they have to deal with, right? Like, crushing temperatures many parts of the trip.
Yeah. Well, okay. The 105 degrees in the gap. Mm-hmm. But then when you get up to Prudhoe Bay, it's 50 below zero. Mm-hmm. So they've got to, you know, be prepared for all that too. Like the difference in temperatures. They said, you know, just that example right there, 105 to 50 below with a wind chill. They said that's like 155 degrees in variance, you know, that they have to deal with on this one trip. And I know it's, you know, some time apart because this whole thing took 122 days.
Right. And think about the effects on the engines, too.
Oh, yeah. The equipment. That's got to be extremely difficult on them. But as I said, you know, they ended up this whole thing with one broken axle. And I think that happened in the gap because I saw them welding on that. On that film, and five flat tires. That's it. Between all six Jeeps. All 15 guys, they kept the equipment in such good shape that it worked out really well.
Which is a bargain when you think about it.
It really is. I mean, you'd almost expect that in your family sedan if you're going to make this
trip. No one's grievously injured.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's the thing is, like, no one really, like, there were no fatalities. There were no, you know, nobody had to be hauled off the hospital or anything like that.
That we know of.
That's true. No, I mean, it all seemed to go really well. I mean, they had planned for everything, and I'm sure there were some, you know, cuts and bruises and scrapes along the way. But that's just the way it worked. Cause there, again, in the gap, I keep going back to the gap stuff because that's the most interesting part of this whole thing, really, to me anyways. We'll talk about some other regions in a moment that maybe interest other people, but, they were using their own bodies as, you know, ballast weight in the jungle, you know, to get over some of these ridges and, you know, through the washes and things. So you'll see footage of, you know, guys hanging on and suddenly the Jeep will jerk violently to the right and everybody falls off to the left, you know, onto the jungle floor. But no one gets, like, you know, broken bones or anything like that along the way.
Would you do this?
Would I do this?
Yeah.
Right now, I probably wouldn't with, you know, the family situation. But if I was a younger Scott Benjamin, yes, I would.
Yeah, I would do it.
You have to refer to yourself in third person.
Oh, okay. Okay, so you would say right now that's not Scott. I would absolutely sign on to something like this, especially if I could get the time off work, or maybe I could just record remotely. What do you think, Scott? I'll do my side of it from a Jeep,
like
in the jungle,
satellite phone. Why not?
Yeah.
Why not? If they can do it from Everest, you might as well do it from there, right?
Yeah.
Why not? All right. So how about this? Let's back it up just a little bit because we said, you know, the gap is really fascinating. It's interesting stuff. And there's probably the most to talk about there, really. But when they left the southernmost tip, you know, down in Chile, they had some serious territory to cross there as well. I mean, there were again, 10,000 miles to get to the gap. So when they left, you know, the first few days were somewhat easy compared to the rest of the trip. I mean, it was cruising right along, but let's get this out of the way too. They had to cross the Andes Mountains three times before they got to the gap. So, you know, one of the crossings is almost right away.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's still, again, relatively easy. It's beautiful scenery along the way, but they're traveling something like 400, 500, even 600 miles each day at first. So, you know, by the time they get to day six, I think, you know, they're still in Chile, I believe, at that point. But they meet up with, like, you know, Chilean cowboys, and they're, you know, having barbecues with them and, you know, trying to really soak in the culture along the way. They're not just driving through and, you know, not really paying attention to what's happening around them. They're getting the culture. They're getting the scenery. By day 13, they're back in the Andes Mountains again. These, again, huge mountains. This is the second time. Really challenging at this point, though, in that second, the second crossing to stay on schedule, because, at this point, you got to imagine what it's like to travel 600 miles every day in a Jeep vehicle with, you know, two or three other guys. It's got to be, it's got to be tough. I mean, it's a real test of endurance. Maybe not quite as tough as, like, you know, the guys that ride the thousand miles a day for 2 weeks or whatever. Remember the Iron Butt rally?
Yeah.
Do you remember that? Maybe it's not that difficult, but it's got to be pretty tough on them. And knowing that they've got another, 110 days ahead of them, that's tough. That's tough to stomach something like that, but they did it. They stuck with it. And by day 21, they had left the mountains behind, and they were in the Atacama Desert. And this is described as the land that God forgot. And the reason, it took them 2 days, but the reason they say that is because there's zero life in the Atacama Desert.
Yeah. This plateau in South America, it's a strip of land. It's the driest. Let me see if I can qualify this correctly. The driest non-polar desert in the world.
It's just absolutely barren. There's just nothing there. And when I said lifeless, I mean that. I mean, they search for life on this all the time. Not all the time, but they did. And there's nothing. No plant life, no animal life, nothing. It's just this barren wasteland. And they cross that it takes them 2 days to get across that. So no oasis in sight, you know, midway or anything like that. But driving, long, long distances. I don't know. If they're covering 400 or 500 or 600 miles a day and they're driving 2 days across this thing, that's got to be a huge desert area. I don't know the distance that was or not. But after they left that, they were on to Peru, and of course that meant crossing the Andes for the third time.
Yeah.
Which again, interesting. This is something interesting here. I thought they had stayed together through the whole thing, but I found out watching that film that they actually broke up into smaller groups. They decided that they were going to choose an adventure, when they got into the Peru area. So they had three groups, and one group went to Lake Titicaca, which is a lake that's 12,000 feet in the air in the Andes Mountains. I didn't know it was that high. Another group went to Machu Picchu, which is a deserted city, right, from the 15th century, the lost city of the Inca. I mean, I think everybody knows what Machu Picchu is. Yeah, they rediscovered it again in 1911, I think it was. And then another group went to Iguazu Falls, which is just an enormous waterfall. Right there in the Andes region. So I thought that was interesting. They joined back up again when they got to Bogota, Bogota, Colombia, and they were still, or I guess I should say this, they were at that point, they were 10,000 miles away from the starting point. So it's been a long journey already.
Right.
But they joined back up again in the city, and I would guess they kind of got themselves together because the next step here would be the Darien Gap.
This is really the crucible in which the group proves its mettle. And undergoes the test. As we said in the beginning, they do make it through without any grievous injury, and the forest swallows their path behind them.
Yeah, what, 31 days?
31 days, and they still have another 10,000 miles to go.
Yeah, 10,000 miles
that's
north.
It.
But see, now at this point, they're in Central America, and they're traveling through a region where you used to live for a while. They're going to go through Guatemala as one of the places, right?
Yeah.
They go through, they go through Panama City, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, and then through Mexico. So have you ever been on the Pan-American Highway? I bet you have.
I don't believe I have, Scott, unfortunately.
You were in Guatemala, but you were in a different part of Guatemala then, as it ran through there.
Yeah.
I've had the good fortune to be on just a little bit of this. I happened to notice it while I was on a bus or something, you know, going somewhere. I don't remember where. I've been in Costa Rica, so I think I might have been on it twice, but just, again, very brief bits of time, you know, like near the airport or something. So nothing, you know, no adventure or anything like that. Nothing like what these guys were up to. And then after they get out of Mexico, Ben, I mean, there's got to be kind of a sense of relief once they cross over into the United States.
Oh, for sure.
And that's because these were all Americans. I don't know if we mentioned that before, but it's kind of like a homecoming. You know, it's like you get a little bit homesick for the way of life that you're accustomed to, really. And that's what they experienced just as they crossed and over, because they had a big cookout. They had, you know, hamburgers and baked beans and stuff like that. You know, they had a big campfire looking, almost looked like a chuck wagon had pulled up or something to feed them. It was not exactly that, but it was, like an American style homecoming, I suppose.
Right.
These guys. So they were all happy and they still got a long way to go because they're headed up towards Alaska.
Yeah.
Through British Columbia.
They're going to go all the way up. And you know, now that I'm thinking about it, just to go back to it, I'm kind of bummed, Scott, that I lived in Guatemala and didn't go on the Panamanian.
You know what? I didn't mean to bring up a sore issue, so I apologize. But
is it possible that I may have and not recognize
it? That's what I'm thinking. I think because it cuts right through there, and you did a lot of bus travel and stuff while you were there, right? I mean, you did some you got around a bit while you were there. It wasn't like you were in one village or something, right?
No. I did a little bit of traveling. You know what? I'm just going to tell myself that I was on it and I didn't recognize it. And then I'll go back.
I'm willing to bet that you at some point were on it and didn't realize it because that's what happened to me. And the only reason I saw it was because I could see out the front window and read a road sign.
Well, I was young, but I still feel like I would have known.
Yeah, well, maybe. Okay. Yeah. Well, hopefully you were.
Hopefully, yes. Hopefully
it's
part
of
history.
Like you said, let's just tell ourselves. You can tell yourself maybe that you
right.
were. All right. Fair enough.
So
they're headed up through, you know, like up to the northern border, I guess, with Canada, through British Columbia and then into Yukon territory, I guess we could even describe that whole road along the way. That's another podcast there, but
yeah.
Once they get up into Alaska, they have to go through, another mountain range at the northern end of Alaska called the Brooks Range. And then from there, of course, you know, on to Prudhoe Bay. But when they were in the Brooks Range, I guess, they had extremely heavy snow that they didn't expect. They knew it was going to be snowy, but they didn't expect it to be quite as snowy as it was.
Mm-hmm.
They said the visibility was cut down to something like 25 feet at one point. And, again, the temperature is 50 below zero with a wind chill, so it's an extreme situation. But the equipment held up. The Jeeps were fine, and they made it. I mean, there was no real drama from that snowstorm or anything other than just trying to get through it with everybody together all in one time.
Yeah.
But when they got to Prudhoe Bay, it looked like it was extremely bitter cold, and they were all celebrating, of course, you know, because they had made their – or finished their journey. Then there's sort of a sad part in the whole film where all the guys are, you know, congratulating each other. But then later, you know, you can tell it's not in Alaska, of course. You know, they're back wherever they are.
Right.
And doing interviews, standing next to the Jeeps, and they're talking about the trip, and they're all a bit sad to return to daily life and have to go back to work again after nearly 5 months off. Was it nearly four months?
4 months, 122 days.
Yeah, 122 days. They've traveled 21,000 miles together, solved all these issues together. They've become lifelong friends. They're
sure
they have a good relationship with each other. So now I can see where this would be a huge letdown to have to just kind of scatter and go your own way at that point. You'd want to continue the adventure.
Yeah,
like, hey everybody, let's go to the east side of Canada.
And we've all felt this in some form or another when you're done with, let's say, listeners out there who are still school age, when you have to go back to school at the end of summer, or you know, camp is over, or something like that.
Yeah, I was going to make the comparison with like a class trip.
Yeah, a class trip. That's a great comparison too, because you get the camaraderie in there.
Bonds are formed that you know you're having a great time, and you don't want it to end. And it's only a weekend, or maybe it's a week, or whatever. Mm. But you just don't want it to end. You'd like it to continue on. But if it did, you know, it might not end up so well. It would lose the magic.
And,
you're right.
And I guess family vacations could be another comparison, but that really depends on how you feel about your family, which is none of our business.
Good point. That can go either way, right?
Yeah. So what's so fascinating, I think, about Mark Smith is both his enterprising and intrepid nature, but also his devotion to Jeeps, man.
Oh, yeah, lifelong devotion. I mean, from the moment he drove one the end of World War II,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, in the 40s. And then he did it for decades after that. And he's always pictured next to Jeeps. So
yeah.
We know that for, you know, six decades after that, he maintained that love of the Jeep product and his role as a leader, like in crossing the Rubicon Trail and Jeep Jamborees and all that. He was a part of that whole thing right up until probably right when he died.
And as the Templar said to Indiana Jones, to paraphrase the Templar, Mark chose wisely because, look, guys, I love Monte Carlos, But there's not a way I'm getting that thing through the Darien Gap, you know?
Probably not.
Yeah. So a Monte Carlo couldn't go there. A lot of cars couldn't. And that includes, and there's a bit of a silver lining, Honda Odysseys.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. So you will not encounter a Honda Odyssey if you were somewhere in the Darien Gap.
One of its main selling points.
Well, maybe you should, that's maybe where you should camp out. Of course, it's full of thieves and robbers, right? That's what we
I guess
now.
Maybe on the edges, but, you know, it's pretty sparsely populated in the interior, so.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
It's one of those places where you go a long time without seeing a person, but also, you know, also when we think about this amazing sense of adventure, and again, the fact that these were not specialized, one-off built vehicles, it's pretty inspiring to realize just what people are capable of when they set their minds to a goal. And I love that you mentioned, you know, there had to be a bit of sadness, and you know, there were probably proposals to, like, hey, let's go start at the tip of Russia, of Siberian Russia.
Do it again.
And drive across, which would be a very different trip.
Yeah, it sure would. Yeah, it's a thing. Like, this is its own unique thing. And honestly, if you want to get the best feel for this story, and I hope that most of our podcasts are like this for you, that, you know, when we describe something or try to describe something, we're doing our best, you know, the best that we can with the medium that we have. But if we had video to go along with this, I'd be able to show you some incredible footage from this trip. And you should search it out and look for it. I mean, even if you just, you know, skim through it real quick and look at a little bit of it here and there. But I do recommend watching the whole thing. It's 27 minutes long, and it really gives you the beginning to end of this whole journey and what they had to go through. And it's in their own words. A lot of them,
right.
You know, there's footage taken along the way, some really great footage, some spectacular footage of, you know, the scenery,
mm-hmm.
and the trials and tribulations they had to go through in the gap. It's just, it's amazing. It's really well done. And again, 1970s, late 1970s, early 1980s. So be kind to it in the comments with that. But
it looks very 70s. We could probably post that up on social media as well if you'd like to check it out. There's a YouTube link.
Yeah, I don't see why not. I can do that.
And then this also makes me think of a question for you, ladies and gentlemen. Do you have a dream road trip? And if so, what is it? It doesn't have to be, you know, spanning two continents and 17 countries. It can be as simple as, you know, like, my dream road trip is to go to my grandfather's house or to drive to the Grand Canyon or something. In my case, for my dream road trips, which is crazy, of course, is I want to drive from Eastern Asia all the way to the coast of Spain or France.
Hmm. That's quite a trip.
Yeah.
Have you ever calculated how many miles and all that is? I mean, have you ever, like, I don't want to hold you to those numbers right now, but have you ever done the calculation to figure out how far it would be and how long it would take you? And I mean, have you investigated or just really kind of dreamed it at this point?
I haven't yet, and I probably should. If I want to make this happen at some point, I need to start calculating the distances, cost of gas, which countries will and will not let me in because I have a bit of a past.
You know, a lot of people dream of, you know, the old Route 66 thing here in the United States.
Yeah, oh, yeah, for
I'm sure.
Sure
that there are, you know, European versions of this, you know, that they have like an old route that is no longer, you know, the primary route anymore. Mm-hmm. That's more picturesque than it is, you know, quick, I guess. It's not the fastest way to get somewhere, but it's the best way to get somewhere.
Yeah, I think road trips in some ways are like modern day pilgrimages, you know, and people might go out. So, and I don't mean the religious connotation. I just mean this traveling for a purpose that makes the journey as important as the destination.
Yeah. You know, a lot of times when I am traveling now, I find that when I get there, I'm almost kind of bored. You know, it's like you get on the highway and you know, a lot of roads are like this, but like I-75, we travel I-75 a lot north and south.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's kind of the same thing. There's gas stations and, you know, restaurants and everything along the way. It's very convenient to travel. It's very fast.
Mm-hmm.
But what you see along the way is not all that spectacular.
Yeah, it becomes homogenous after a certain amount of time.
Yeah, you get no idea of the little towns that you're going past now. You know, it used to be that you would go either through them or right next to them, but you were on smaller roads.
You were on, like, state roads.
Well, sure, yeah. It was a lot smaller, you know, even if it was two lanes one way, but or you know, even one lane each way, you got to see a lot more of Americana, I guess, maybe is a better way to say it. You got to see a lot more of these tiny towns and of course, it took a lot longer to get wherever you're going. I get that. But I oftentimes will like to pull off the highway and take the smaller roads to get to the final destination. You know, maybe not the whole way because you have to get there kind of quick, you know, time constraints with jobs or school or whatever.
Yeah, I do that when I'm driving as well.
Yeah, it's nice to, you know, maybe, you know, a planned stop, you know, 100 miles away, and then from that point on to your final destination, you're going to take the old route.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for the regional, the regional icons or things of note, you know, like, I will stop if I'm driving by myself. I will stop anytime I see a sign for a museum I've never heard of, or you know, historic mounds are this way. Mm-hmm. I've stopped at some things that were obviously tourist traps, but that's part of it, and that's part of what makes these so great. You know, for those of you who are out there who are as interested in road trips as Scott and I are, why not check out some of our earlier podcasts? We have one on the very first road trip, which is a great story.
Mm-hmm.
And we have several road trip
episodes. I think we did one on roadside attractions, didn't we?
We
and
did.
How some are scams and some are – those are funny. Some of them are really, really
funny. Oh, yeah. World's fourth largest frying pan.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah. See the giant squirrel or something, you know, crazy things like that you end up – you know, you pay $5 and then you go through a maze made out of hay that you can't see where you're headed to, and then they show you some paper mache squirrel or something. And I mean, it's silly, but you know, it's fun. It's also a lot of fun. Or the mystery spots, you know.
Yeah.
We've got a whole episode on just those, and it's way, way back in our history. So, you know, go to Car Stuff Show.
Yes, carstuffshow.com.
And that way you can find it, because you're not going to find that one on iTunes. It's way too far in the past.
That's a deep cut, my friends.
Yes.
But you can find those episodes along with every episode we have ever done on the website Scott just mentioned. You may have heard us mention some social media. That's right. Even though we can be a bit curmudgeonly on our show, we're with the times. We're hip. We know about the internet. True story. We're on Facebook and Twitter, where we're CarStuffHSW. You can find some additional stories that may not have made it into an audio podcast, as well as some stuff that will give a little more depth to the understanding of the topics that we're exploring, such as today's episode. And in the meantime, if you've got like the perfect road trip idea, or if you have an idea for a topic that we should cover in an upcoming episode of Car Stuff, we'd love to hear from you. You can write to us directly at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.